Before we go on to your activities with the state government, there are one or two things that I'd like to return to. One was the Ethics Committee.
Yes, for some 6 years I was chairman of the new committee of the American Political Science Association, newly created, a committee on professional ethics, rights, and freedoms. And this was a rather interesting assignment. The committee was not an adjudicative body. It merely gave advice when its advice was requested. And the advice took the form of rather formal published advisory opinions. And over a course of since 1969, when the committee was founded, the committee has now published about, 18 advisory opinions on a wide variety of subjects. Without going into too great detail, the subjects included such matters as multiple submission of manuscripts, open access to documentation and data, permissions to reprint, the academic marketplace. We had several advisory opinions on job seeking and job offering, appraising manuscripts and reviewing books, fraud in claiming advanced degrees, books and articles stemming from doctoral dissertations, promptness in appraising manuscripts, association electioneering, public statements involving the name of the association, recommending candidates for faculty appointments, and so on. So we, over the years, the committee is still functioning, did try to state and to codify some basic rules of professional ethics for the political science profession. Perhaps I should add that this is the this is now characteristic of many learned bodies. Many associations of scholars have set up ethics committees to do this sort of thing. There's a great deal of sensitivity to ethical problems these days, and a strong desire to spell out in formal language what's right and what's wrong.
Well, sort of connected with this, you were talking about the your activities with the AAUP. I was wondering just what role the AAUP has played here on the Madison campus.
Well, there's an old saying, it's an old saying for me at least, that every university president gets the AAUP chapter he deserves. And while we've always had a large chapter in Madison, it has always been inactive because the things which AAUP stands for, we do here anyhow, without any pushing on the part of AAUP. Where you get an active chapter is where you have serious problems of academic freedom and tenure, which stir the faculty to action. So that the relative inactivity of the AAUP chapter here is a reflection of the fact that our university community is already committed. That means the regents and the administrative offices are already strongly committed to those standards which AAUP seeks to promote throughout the country. So it's very hard to say how much influence we've had. I think we've had a lot of influence in the sense that the basic rules and regulations governing the faculty and its relations with the administration here follow AAUP guidelines. And indeed, some of our rules follow AAUP language taken from documents. A great achievement of AAUP over the years has been the adoption of documents which spell out specifically what are proper, what are improper practices in higher education. It's set a standard according to which we can make judgments as to whether administrations in our colleges and universities are acting properly or improperly. So I would guess that that on the one hand, our AAUP chapter is not engaged in warfare with the administration, but on the other hand, the administration is already doing what AAUP has long since set out to accomplish.
It sounds from what you just said that perhaps some other campuses and other places may not have this.
Oh, my. The American Association of University Professors will never run out of business. They get about 1,000 complaints a year from professors of allegations of some sort of mistreatment, some violation of what AUP regards as proper procedures. And I don't see any evidence that the AUP office is ever going to run out of work. They have a tremendous number now. That doesn't mean that all those 1,000 complaints are meritorious. Many are looked into and dismissed out of hand as lacking totally in any merit. But the AUP does process hundreds of complaints every year. There are a lot of schools that are very badly run in this country. We had one case when I was chairman of Committee A where the president of the college involved admitted that he had never heard of academic tenure. He was in a backwater school. He just didn't know. We had to teach him. It's like teaching a kid the alphabet. But we had to teach him the basic facts of life about academic tenure.
That does surprise me.
He was not familiar with the concept.
Oh, my. This might be a good time to answer a question of mine. The subject of tenure, which I had long taken as absolute fact and definite, has been coming under scrutiny in the last year or two, maybe longer. And I'm wondering what you see in this relationship.
Are you referring to our campus or
no,
generally?
Well, the system perhaps.
Well, I think that especially since the pinch came in with inflation and with diminished financial resources, more and more college administrators and governors look longingly at the faculties to see if they can figure out some way of getting rid of the high-priced faculty people who have academic tenure. And every now and then we have a case where some college administration actually seeks to abolish tenure. I don't think it's all that common. I was the head of an investigating committee just a couple of years ago, which looked into the practices of a college president in northern New Jersey, who actually did seek to abolish tenure. And he sought to cut his costs by firing about a dozen tenured professors and hiring young non-tenured people at a lower salary level. But we took him to court. We made a lawsuit out of it, and we won our suit. And the principle of tenure, I'm glad to say, has survived at this college in northern New Jersey. But well, I don't think we'll ever run out of problems of that kind. But on the whole, I think that the principle of academic tenure, which is firmly respected here at Wisconsin, is in a pretty healthy condition nationally.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Mm-hmm. You can't have academic freedom if a person has to worry about whether he can have his job or keep his job or have it renewed. Because he says something that is unpopular or that the governing board or the president or the governor of the state doesn't like. Tenure, the ultimate case for academic tenure is that it protects our academic freedom. It also gives us job security. Like most normal people, professors like job security.
Of course.
It probably functioned better with it than without it.
Well, of course, it's been suggested, I guess, in the press that there are people with tenure who don't really deserve it, and there's all sorts of arguments of this sort that you see.
I suppose that every school makes mistakes and confers tenure upon people who turn out to be unworthy of it. On the other hand, AUP sanctions a probationary period of 7 years. Now, I don't know of any profession that has as demanding a probationary requirement as we have. 7 years is an awful long time. It's a good piece of a person's life. And a school ought to be able to make a decent judgment about a professor after having him around for 7 years. But even so, mistakes are made. Sometimes a hard-working professor eases up and decides to make an easy job, but once he has tenure. And I would simply say that the advantages to higher education as a whole accruing from the tenure system are so great that the occasional mistake we make is well worth the price.
That's good to know.
Well, I just don't think we'd be better off if everyone was insecure about his job all the time and had to live on his knees so far as his administrators are concerned.
Yeah, I agree. Now, another matter you just touched on briefly was the university club. And since you did say, I think, that you were chairman of that committee at some point, I was wondering what your responsibilities were and what was going on at that time.
Being president of the university club is an easy job. There's a little board of directors, and they meet once a month. The university club depends almost entirely on the ability and intelligence and willingness to work of the director. And we had a wonderful woman who was our director of the club for, I think, some 40 years.
Is this Mildred Lindquist?
Yes. Mildred, I think that was the only job she ever had. She worked at the club for her whole life. And now we have a new director who's very good, and I'm sure that the president doesn't have much to do. He presides over the monthly meeting of the board and keeps an eye on the budget and helps to prepare the budget. And I suppose, in a sense, the president is the liaison between the club and the university administration. Somebody has to talk to the chancellor once in a while to make sure that he knows what's going on. The university club can't function without some subsidy, some support from the university. And therefore, it's important that the club keep its channels of communication with the administration pretty open and clean.
Were you involved with it at the time when there was the talk of moving it to the top of Hill and Whitehall?
Oh, yes. I was not as active then as I was, as I became later, but when we built Helen White, there was the thought that we might add two stories on top of what they have there now and make that the club. It would be a wonderful location with parking downstairs, central location. But it got hung up on the question of whether we would be allowed to have a bar there. And
you mean because it was a university building?
A university building. And I always thought it was a kind of a phony issue. We sell liquor. Liquor is sold in the university club now, which is housed in a university building on State Street. But I guess our professors aren't big drinkers. I never see anybody drinking down there. A few people like a glass of wine with their lunch, but certainly they don't make much money from their liquor business down there. We also had a chancellor, Bob Fleming, who was a little reluctant to carry the issue to the regents and to get them to approve of a club with a bar on top of the classroom building in the center of the campus. It may be that with some other chancellor we might have been able to pull it off. It's a pity. That would have been a beautiful place for faculty.
Yes, it would have. View of the lake and everything.
And right in the middle of things. Good location and parking downstairs for those who have to come from far away. So we're pretty well stuck with the building we're in now.
Well, there's talk even of doing something about that, I guess. I don't know how soon that might happen. Or
I don't know.
What?
It's not a live issue as far as I know.
Mm. I was just curious. Now, do you want to get on to your work with the state? before we talk about the political science department, or
yes,
the other way around?
No, let's go to the state government. I had six very interesting years. I'm not by nature deeply involved in active politics, but during the 4 years of Gaylord Nelson as governor, Gaylord Nelson was governor from 1960 to 64, and then the 2 years of John Reynolds, who is now a federal judge in Milwaukee. During those 6 years of these two liberal Democratic governors, I guess I had my major political experience. They were both very close personal friends. They invited me to their parties out at the governor's mansion. And I was in the circle of discussion that surrounds the governor, whoever the governor may be. My main function for both governors was to write speeches for them. I did a lot of speech writing, especially for Nelson. The governor of Wisconsin is terribly understaffed, and these two governors did not have sufficient help to upon whom they could rely for the preparation of good speeches. So my main usefulness to these two men was to write some of their major speeches. And
this was done on a volunteer basis? I mean,
oh yes, I wasn't paid for it. It was just done in my spare time. But I enjoyed being part of their administration, and it was interesting to meet with them and talk about the problems of state government from time to time. But in addition, I had a number of experiences with state government. In 1959, I was appointed to the Governor's Commission on Human Rights, and I remained on that commission for 9 years. As I recall, I asked not to be reappointed in 1968, so that from 1959 to 1968, I was member of the commission. That was an interesting experience, though how much we accomplished, I don't know. I think it was we raised the right questions, and people who had a complaint to make on civil rights had a place to come to.
What kind of questions did you raise?
We did have some access to the governor. I suppose the largest number of issues involved discrimination against blacks more than any other form of discrimination. In fact, one reason why I was quite willing to get off the commission was my conviction that since most of the problems confronting the commission involved black people, that the commission itself would be more credible if it had black members, and that the black community didn't look to people like myself for any particular leadership. But that's how it developed. But I've been away from it for so long that I don't know what's going on right now. I think it's less active than it used to be. But when I was on the commission, the spark plug that really made it run was Rebecca Barton, whose husband was a member of our faculty. And Becky Barton was, as many people in Madison know, was a remarkable woman, and she was the real spark plug of the commission and kept it moving along. She had a great deal of imagination and great intelligence and great commitment to civil rights.
Did you deal with such issues as housing, for instance?
Yes, we had a lot of housing questions and employment questions, all turning on the issue of discrimination. Then Governor Nelson thought that that the Wisconsin Constitution was getting out of date, needed revision, and appointed a commission on constitutional revision in 1960. and put me on it. He put me on the commission. It consisted of several professors. I remember Willard Hurst of our law faculty was on it, and a number of members of the legislature were on it. I remember Walter Hollander, the eminent state senator, was a member of the commission. I'd be hard put to remember who else was on it. There were about 15 or 20 of us. And we made a number of basic recommendations, and to my surprise, really, because I didn't expect it to happen, while we had no authority except to recommend certain amendments to the Constitution, over the years they've been adopted. And as I look back, we did not waste our time. The things that we approved of and recommended and reported on have eventually been adopted by the legislature and by the voters at constitutional referenda and are now part of the law of the state of Wisconsin. For example, we recommended that we go from a 2 to a 4 year term for the governor and for other statewide officers, and although it took a separate amendment for each officer, one for the governor, one for the lieutenant governor, and so on, all of that has been approved by the legislature and the voters. It is now part of the Constitution. Governor Reynolds appointed a second commission on constitutional revision in 1964, and we sat during his 2 years. He made me secretary of the commission, and we made some additional recommendations and repeated some of the recommendations made by the earlier commission. We had a very lively debate as to whether we should recommend that we have a constitutional convention, but we were sharply divided on that issue, but legislature didn't want a convention, and I'm glad they didn't call one.
Why are you glad?
Well, you never know. A convention is a very iffy thing. You don't know who's going to be elected to it and what they're going to do, and you may lose more of your constitution than you may gain. So the lesson I drew from our experience between 1960 and 1966 is that piecemeal revision of a constitution is possible. And there's another batch of amendments which have just been approved that have really eliminated from the Constitution many, many provisions which were completely out of date, had no relationship to anything now going on. Constitutions tend to get obsolete. I mean, some provisions tend to get obsolete and have to be touched up. The section on voting, which we had until the last constitutional referendum, our section on voting was completely out of date. It was unconstitutional as far as the federal constitution is concerned, and it's been revised to make it conform with the law of the land.
I certainly see the need for that.
Yes. And just 3 years ago, I was appointed to a committee of the Legislative Council, a special committee on constitutional and statutory review. I have a note here that we worked during 1978 and 79. Midge Miller, the local representative in the assembly, was chairman of that committee, and most of the committee members were members of the legislature, selected by the Legislative Council, but they had a few lay members, and I was one of them. And they had several lawyers on it. And we recommended a number of changes in the Constitution which would at least eliminate obsolete provisions or update provisions that were no longer proper, constitutionally speaking. And we had very good luck. We also recommended substantial revisions in our statutes. And one of the things we did was to take out as many Latin phrases as we could. Our thought was that the Constitution should be, our statute should be phrased in the language of the land, which is English and not Latin. So we de-Latinized our statute books. We took out a large number of phrases wherever we could. We also tried to de-sex some of our statutes by making it clear that that the statutes include women as well as men. The old assumption was that the word he meant she by inference, but it's now he or she, and so we sort of desexed the statute book to some extent.
Well, that'll make a lot of people happy.
Yes, and we gave marching orders to the statute reviser as to what we thought he should be doing to continue the process of revising statutes. The collected statutes of a state need constant attention, and it's very wise to have an occasional committee set up to have a fresh look at the documents that we live with to see if they're still consistent with the facts of life. I also served the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin had was asked by the television and radio people if they would permit a change in the rules of the court to permit the use of electronic broadcasting equipment in courtrooms. Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1970, and I was asked to serve as chairman, and it consisted of judges and lawyers and a few lay people, and including people from the media, and we were very sharply divided. As I recall, we recommended against the introduction of television cameras in the courtroom by a margin of one vote. I think we were divided 8-7 or 9-8, something like that.
What were the reasons against?
Well, let me finish this story. And then it went to the Supreme Court, and they were divided. And I think their final vote was, there's seven of them, they went 4-3 against the use of electronic equipment in the courtroom. Television and radio are not permitted in any federal courtroom by Supreme Court rules, but many states now permit the media to come in. The main objection to having television cameras is the fear that the presence of the camera would exert a distracting influence on the parties that are involved, on witnesses. The witnesses might be overborne or overawed by the fact that a camera is on them, and by the thought that the whole community may be watching. There was even a fear that lawyers would grandstand in front of the cameras, that judges would misbehave or grandstand because they have their eye on the next election. But I think the main problem is the problem or the fear of distraction, that you're bringing into the courtroom a factor which has a distracting potential. Well, the media people kept at the court, and in 1978, the court established a new committee to report on the use of cameras in the courtroom. And this time, I was asked to serve as chairman, and this time I think we were unanimous, or almost unanimous, in recommending that television cameras be permitted. And we also drafted the rules, which the court had to adopt to make them official and binding. We drafted the rules, some 20 different rules, governing how many cameras there could be in the courtroom and how they should be positioned and so on. And we also drafted rules for radio and for still photography as well. And the Supreme Court in 79 accepted our report after a hearing in the court at which I spoke for the committee. And now we are one of, I think about half the states of the union now permit cameras in the courtroom. It's still a lively issue, and it's being debated around the country, and still being debated in Wisconsin. But I had a hand in that problem over the years.
Well, now this represents a change of view. You said that it was unanimous.
I was opposed to it 10 years ago. I just changed my mind.
I see.
I decided that that the television people are in the news business just as newspapers are, and they ought to have a right to do what they're equipped to do. I might add that there's been a remarkable improvement in the quality of television cameras. They don't make the noise they used to make. They're noiseless. And you don't need any bright lights. We forbid bright lights. You have to use whatever lights the courtroom has. But our courtrooms are better lit now than they used to be, and furthermore, the cameras are so much more sensitive that you can get a pretty good picture without any bright light. You wouldn't want to permit the bright lights of the camera people in a courtroom. That would certainly be distracting. So I just changed my mind, I guess, but I think some of the facts changed over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, I imagine that, of course, that in terms of news, it reaches a larger audience than an article in a newspaper, for instance.
Oh, indeed. As I often have said, television is here to stay, and you might as well face the fact that my guess is that more people rely on television for the news than on the newspapers. That would be a close question, but that would be my guess. In any event, they're in the news business up to their eyeballs, and why they should not be permitted to cover the trials when reporters are there to cover them for the print media is a fair question. In any event, we've now had cameras in the courtroom for a couple of years, and I don't see any great tidal wave of opinion that would like to get them out of there. I might add that one objection to television in the courtroom is that the argument that they televise only the few sensational trials and thus call attention to them, but that's equally true of the newspapers. They only cover the sensational trials. They don't cover routine litigation. Maybe they should, but they don't. So that what's sauce for the goose, it seems to me, is sauce for the gander.
Well, it seems to be working okay, in other words.
As far as I know, it's all right. I think it's probably an improvement. And people learn about their courts by watching the snippets that come out on television.
Well, now, is there anything more about your state or national activities that you...
Well, I was just thinking, I just finished an assignment. We have in Wisconsin an integrated bar by court order. In 1956, I think it was, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin adopted rules which created an integrated bar. An integrated bar means that that in order to be licensed to practice law in Wisconsin, a lawyer must belong to the State Bar Association and pay dues. And this is a very hotly debated subject all over the country, although I think a majority of the states now have integrated bars. But the Supreme Court of the state gave notice a couple of years ago that in 1982 it was going to review the desirability of an integrated bar. There's still vigorous opposition from some lawyers who simply don't like the compulsory character of bar membership. And the Bar Association, in anticipating the appointment by the court of a court committee, appointed its own committee about 2 years ago under the chairmanship of the dean of the Marquette Law School. And it consists entirely of lawyers. It consisted of lawyers plus three laymen, and I was one of the lay members. We worked very hard for a whole year on a report, which we completed not very long ago, and in which we recommended that the integrated bar be retained. Just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court appointed its own advisory committee. And I think just this weekend it's going to have a public hearing, And those who wish to appear and speak for or against the integrated bar are invited to come. It's a very lively issue, and I found that a very interesting assignment. I had no doubt myself of the desirability of an integrated bar. The compulsory feature didn't trouble me very much. I just don't like to have freeloaders who have all the advantages of or the organized bar without helping to pay the cost, which is the way I look at it.
Now, by integrated bar, just what are you talking about?
Well, as I said, the integrated bar means that in order to be licensed to practice law in Wisconsin, the lawyer has to be a member of the State Bar Association and pay dues to the Bar Association. That is what is meant by an integrated bar, as distinguished from a voluntary association. The main objection, I might say, and it's not without weight, the main objection to an integrated bar, aside from some abstract dislike of compulsion, the main objection is that the Bar Association often lobbies at the legislature for legislation of special interest to lawyers. And many lawyers argue that they should not be required to pay dues to finance lobbying for bills to which they are opposed. And
their dues supposedly go for this.
Well, their dues, yes, lobbyists are paid by one of the permanent employees of the State Bar Association is a full-time, practically a full-time lobbyist. And his salary comes out of the Bar Association dues. I would say I was persuaded that the Bar Association, the Board of Governors of the Bar Association is very reluctant to engage in lobbying. They're very careful not to get involved in legislation concerning which lawyers themselves are divided. So that, and we recommended in our report that they try hard to avoid getting involved in lobbying for highly controversial legislation concerning which members of the bar may be in disagreement. But it's a real problem. I don't poo-poo it. I just think the arguments for an integrated bar outweigh those against it.
Well, are the dues very high?
No, about right now they're around $100 a year. That isn't very much, not considering the earning power of lawyers these days. Dues were never very high.
I see. Now, is it still true, as it used to be, that graduates from the law school here do not have to take a bar examination?
That's right. There's, I think, seven states that still have what is called the diploma privilege, which means that if you have a law degree from the University of Wisconsin Law School here in Madison or the Marquette Law School in Milwaukee, that you're admitted to the bar without bar exams. It's called the diploma privilege, and I think it exists only in about seven states now. It's rapidly disappearing, but the concept is well deeply rooted here, and when the law dean goes to the court and assures the court that these men and women that he presents are qualified to practice law, the court is inclined to take his word for it.
Well, shall we go on now to discussing the political science department?
Well, let me mention one other thing. Had a long debate in this state on the reorganization of our court system. And I think, as is well known, just recently we amended the Constitution substantially to provide for an intermediate level of appellate courts, we call them the appeals courts, to take some of the burden of review off of the hands of the seven justices of the state Supreme Court. We also had a dual system of courts at the trial level with county courts and circuit courts. And there was a long movement to first introduce intermediate appellate courts and make and limit the access to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And secondly, to have a unified trial court at the local level. And this, of course, we did with very important amendments to our Constitution. Well, I was deeply involved in that whole movement. We had a Wisconsin Citizens Conference on Judicial Organization, which worked on the problem and developed the data and a great deal of the public education necessary for it. And later on, we had a steering committee of a committee for court modernization in Wisconsin, on which I served. So I had a hand, I wouldn't exaggerate the weight of my own hand, but I did have a hand in the modernization of, and the very serious reorganization of the Wisconsin court system. Now we have a unified trial court instead of having both county and circuit courts. We have a single circuit court, and we have four appellate courts around the state with our Supreme Court here in Madison. So I think that was my last bit of good works as a concerned citizen.
How has this worked out?
Oh, I think it's worked out very well. I also think that we don't have enough data yet, and I've been urging my friends in the law school to get some law students or someone over there to work on what has happened since court reorganization. Especially, we don't have very good data on what difference the appellate courts have made. How many cases go, for example, from the appellate courts, from the appeals courts, to the Wisconsin Supreme Court? We don't know, and it's time, I think, to evaluate how the court reorganization or modernization has worked out. I'm just guessing when I say that I think it's worked out pretty well, as far as I know. It has relieved the Supreme Court of an impossible burden of appeals and has provided cheaper and quicker review to parties who wish to have their cases reviewed at least once by the appeals courts.
Sounds like a very good idea.
I think it is, and it's something that's going on all over the country. Now you want to talk about our department?
Well, sooner or later I do, yes.
Yeah. I've been thinking about what to tell you, Donna. I probably was less active in the department than I was in the general faculty over the years. I never wanted to be a chairman, was never asked to be chairman, and never served as chairman of the department, and was not even very active in the committees of the department. But I did attend department meetings faithfully and didn't shirk my duties as a member of the department. I suppose the most important single thing that's happened to the department since I came here in 1947 is its growth. When I first came here, we had about 7 or 8 people in the department. We now have around 35, which is a very considerable change. And one of the most time-consuming chores of tenured members of a department is to select young people to come in at the lower levels who will someday be seniors themselves. And all of us devoted a great deal of time to canvassing the country and reading correspondence and documents and publications and interviewing candidates and then arguing about them in department meetings. But my guess is that the most significant single function I performed as a member of the department for some 30 years was that I had a hand, no greater hand than anybody else, but I had a hand in the growth of the department by the selection of new personnel. At the University of Wisconsin, there's a tendency not to interfere with the way an individual teaches his courses, and certainly in our department, in the political science department, no one tells a professor how to teach his course, or when to examine students, or what books the student should read. There's no supervision of the individual professor, no matter what his rank. An assistant professor has the same freedom to to plan his courses according to his best judgment that a full professor has. So that we haven't spent any time over the years in that respect. On the other hand, what does consume a lot of department time is the care and feeding of graduate students. This is, University of Wisconsin is the number one producer of PhDs in the country, speaking of the university as a whole. And if we're not number one, we're always in the top three. We produce about 700-800 PhDs a year here at Wisconsin. And the political science department in the last few years has produced around 20 PhDs a year. And they are a matter of deep concern. There's constant discussion of the examining system for the so-called prelim examinations, and we're always being importuned by graduate students to change the way we do things. And we have over the years made many changes. For example, after long and anxious debate, we dropped the foreign language requirement for the PhD, unless a foreign language was necessary for the person's research field. For example, if one wants to get a PhD in Latin American affairs, he would have to know Spanish. If a graduate student wants to sit in Professor Armstrong's seminar on Russian government, he must be able to read Russian. But unless a foreign language is related to the student's major academic interests, we no longer require languages just to require them. I shall never forget how at Yale, during my graduate years, I sweated through German. I needed German like I needed a hole in the head. I don't think I've looked at a German book since I passed my prelim, and I still blush at the thought of the miserable performance I gave to the professor who examined me. But I was in constitutional law and American political theory, and I didn't need German. And to require German of me was just an empty historical gesture. At one time, Germany was the heart of scholarship, of the scholarly world. And that's why we required German. But no one looks to Germany nowadays for scholarly ideas. The heart of advanced scholarship in the modern world is right here in this country. And English will get you by just very well indeed. But we spent a lot of time over the years debating how to examine the graduate students, whether to give them a second chance if they fail, whether they have to take all their exams within a single week, or it can take them one at a time. These are very time-consuming problems, and the department also devotes a great deal of energy to placing them. These young people don't have connections around the country, and they rely upon the professors to find their first jobs. So we have a very active, very successful placement service. I might say that it's been a joy that while it's terribly difficult to find a position in history or English these days, political science is still a good job, a good field for job placement. It's still an expanding field, and we have managed to place every year, including last year, every graduate student who was in a position to request placement. So we've done pretty well.
I was wondering about that. That was going to be another question, but you've answered it already.
Yes. I think that as a department, the major energies of the members of the department as a group are devoted to personnel problems, recruitment and promotion of people in the department, and the what I call the care and feeding of graduate students, who take an awful lot of our time.
Well, that's
beyond that,
we have
the normal problems that all departments have. We are an assemblage of human beings. We have problems relating to each other, but there's nothing special there to report. Actually, as departments go, the political science department during my tenure here was a very good-natured and amicable place in which to work. Relations among members of the department are quite friendly, and it's been a very pleasant place in which to spend one's years as a teacher. I can't say that for all departments around here. Oh, I forgot to say, something was bothering me. There's been an increasing interest in political science with the rush to the law schools. As everyone knows, there's been a tremendous rush to the law schools in the last 10 years or so. And pre-law students quite correctly judged that a political science major is probably the best preparation for studying for a law school program. And it's the great increase in law school enrollments that has had the effect of increasing the enrollments in political science courses.
Well, of course, if you increase the enrollments, I imagine this is meant increasing the staff, the faculty.
Yes, although in the last few years, the financial constraints being what they are, it's meant larger classes, too. Mm-hmm. We have a large number of very large classes, larger than they should be, for maximum effectiveness. It's an unfortunate thing.
Well, it's also been suggested to me that there's been an increase in the number of area studies specialties in political science.
Yes, that's quite true. And that's a post-World War II development. We've had specialists here in African studies, Southeast Asia, and Latin America, and Western Europe, and the communist countries, Eastern Europe. We have two specialists on Eastern Europe right now. That's quite true. And there's been a great deal of interest among graduate students in area studies. Although I think it's beginning to taper off. I think one of the attractions for area studies was that it held out to graduate students the chance of foreign travel. You can't write a dissertation on Chile unless you go to Chile, and so you figure out some way of getting there. But I think there's been a falling off of interest in area studies and a growth of interest in what we call American studies.
Well, that's interesting. Has there been any interest in using studies in psychology and sociology and bringing them to bear on political science?
There certainly has, to the point where I've often said that political science is a discipline in search of a subject matter, because some of the things that pass for political science today amaze me. I just don't understand why they're called political science.
What are you thinking of?
Well, we have a PhD field called political psychology. And I don't know whether the faculty people who work on political psychology are political scientists or psychologists. And I don't think they know themselves. There's been a tremendous development of arithmetical or quantitative political methods in political science, to the point where I am no longer able to read half the articles that appear in our journals. It's a very sobering thought that after 50 years in the profession, I take the American Political Science Review and half the articles I can't read at all. I don't understand the complex mathematical formula that they embody. I'm not sure that these quantifiers are getting all that of an achievement out of what they're doing. Usually when I look at their conclusions, they're proving something that we've always known. But in any event, many people in political science are not distinguishable from psychologists or sociologists or economists or historians. I have a vague feeling that we're drifting towards the recreation of a unified social science, something like the old political economy that we used to have before we separated economics from politics. I don't know how long I will live, but it may well be that someday we will have a unified social science instead of these specialties that we now have. I think it will be very unfortunate. I think much of the progress in scholarship in this country and in the amount of knowledge we have available is the result of specialization. But it wasn't so long ago that political science was split off from history. When I attended the University of Nebraska as a freshman in 1925, they just that year separated psychology from philosophy. It was one department. Now I think both the philosophers and the psychologists are much better off in separate departments than to go on the pretense that they have so much in common that they belong together. And I think that political science made progress by being split off from history and from economics. But the drift is in the other direction, and an awful lot of people, including members of my own department, are doing things that I don't even recognize as political science and don't understand.
You think they belong more properly back in history or economics?
Well, I just regret the fact that the discipline is no longer a discipline with parameters, that a lot of them are doing things, they're doing good things, but they're doing things that I don't recognize as political science. So I repeat that I think we're a discipline in search of the subject matter, and that at the moment things are in a terrible state of flux.
What effect they might have had on this department?
That's a question which is very difficult to answer. It did not disrupt the department. As a matter of fact, the graduate students in political science behaved quite well during the time of troubles. The enormous uproar on the campus had a serious impact on us as individuals, more than on us as a department. It had a tremendous impact on me.
Will you explain?
Well, I was just ready to quit. If we had had one more bad year, I think I would have simply accelerated my retirement. Here you can retire at age 65 without penalty, and I was getting close to that. But those were the worst years of my life, were the years when we had the militia here on the campus to keep order, and when I walked through rows of armed soldiers to reach my classroom. I was tear gassed 3-4 times. A lot of the excitement was right outside my window here in front of Bascom Hall. But those were miserable. It was a miserable time. I didn't suffer any personal indignities, but it just bothered me to see what was going on, and the students were in a state of perennial excitement and indeed in a state of uproar much of the time. It was a bad time, and it's a commentary on how tough the university is as an institution that survived at all. But we never closed our doors, and we had periods of time when we weren't doing a very good job of educating our students. I don't think to answer your question, while it had a profound impact on me, I don't think it had any special impact on the department as a department. I don't recall that the department ever had to take a stand as a department. We were not confronted with the kind of issues that some other departments had. A lot depended on the nature of the makeup of your graduate student group, and we had a pretty good group here, I guess. Maybe political science, by its very nature, is a sort of a law and order discipline, and the graduate students understood that.
How about TAs? There was a TA strike in about 1970. Did this create a problem for your department?
Some. The president of the TAs was one of our students for 1 year, as I recall. And
who was this?
I forgot his name.
Oh, we can look that up.
There's a chap I didn't like very much, but I forgot his name. And I have no idea what's happened to him. But we had our share of difficulties. There was one big strike, and I think all but one or two of our TAs joined the strike. I had a TA of my own. That is, I selected him on my violas allowance, and we had a few tense moments. I felt badly for him because he felt that if he didn't go on strike, that the other graduate students would look down on him, or he'd lose standing among his peers. Poor boy. But I told him, I said, I've treated you as a young colleague, but if you insist that I treat you as a hired hand, I'll treat you as a hired hand. I said, go ahead and strike. But if that's the relationship you want with me, so be it. I said, I'd rather have a collegial relationship rather than a master and servant relationship, but that's up to you. And after much agonizing, he was a very delightful young man from California. After much soul searching, he decided not to join the strike. stayed on my good side. It wouldn't have bothered me very much. I just used him to grade exams. I wasn't giving an exam at the time. But that was the only direct experience that I had since I didn't make much use of TAs. But the department as a whole had its problems, because all our TAs, I think with one or two exceptions, did go on the long strike.
Well, some departments, I've been told, had serious problems.
Oh, indeed.
Time. Others escaped rather
nicely. We had some unpleasantness. One of the TAs specialized in writing insulting things about the professors in the department. I remember his sneering at my office library and saying it's just full of old books. Well, they're not all my books are old, but you'd have to be some kind of a ignoramus not to recognize that even old books can be pretty good. Mm-hmm. Not all the good books were written in the last few months, but they pestered us a little, but it wasn't anything we couldn't live with. But the turmoil on the campus as a whole was shattering on our nerves and on our sense of well-being, and it simply robbed us of the great pleasures that are involved in university teaching. We had a bad time here at Wisconsin, and I don't think I could have taken more than one more year. I was determined not to. But things quieted down, and while we never got back to where we were before, it hasn't been too bad in the last few years. Incidentally, my golden years at Wisconsin were the years with the returning GIs right after World War II. Those were very good years. The graduate students were older and had more experience with life, better motivation. A lot of them were married, had responsibilities, and they did their work very well. And the budgets kept growing. We weren't short of money. Deans could be generous. Salaries were rising. And in the 50s, for a short time, I think we were even ahead of the inflation. We actually improved our standard of living. In the last 10 years, we've lost in terms of a standard of living, but in those golden years, I'd say roughly from 1948 to about 1960 was the high point of my life as a professor. I call that the golden age for the university.
Well, from everything I've heard, I think this opinion is shared by many.
Yes, those were very good years.
Now, there's one other thing that it's not really connected with the department, but it is connected with the university. But I came across mention of the fact that in the faculty meeting you made a motion to abolish boxing. And I'm wondering about the circumstances of this.
Oh,
I understand is before it actually, I know that it was precipitated finally by the death of a student, but...
Yes, it was a very nice young man who was hit on the head in a boxing match down at the field house and died. And he was a good friend of my daughter's, my daughter, who was then a student at the university, and she felt very badly about it, and I felt badly about it. I never approved of boxing as a college sport. I don't even approve of it as a professional sport. I just don't think the brain case can take the poundings that boxers have to take and not be damaged. But I always thought it was an inappropriate college sport. I went to one of the boxing matches just to see what it was like. And it was at the field house. And in one match, the Wisconsin boxer had the other boxer from the other team on the ropes. That is, he was obviously beating him up. And all around me, people were standing on their feet, screaming, "Kill him, kill him." And I said to myself that this is a heck of a college sport where you shout, "Kill him, kill him." That's inappropriate in an institution committed to the better things of life.
And doesn't sound much like sport, does it?
It doesn't sound like higher education either.
No.
And I'm not a crusader, and I'm certainly not a crusader against athletics. I'm not opposed to the athletic program, although I have some reservations about some aspects of it. But I just thought boxing was an improper sport. I might add that the University of Wisconsin was the only quality university in the country that still had a boxing team.
Well,
yes, and we kept it alive because of the sheer weight of our influence and reputation. But we had to go all the way to the West Coast and the East Coast to find a team to box against. Hmm. It was such a rare sport among colleges and universities. Most of them did not have boxing. And but I got involved quite by accident. I was sitting around a big table at the Tripp Commons, where the faculty used to eat in the old days. And I made some remark to the men around the table that it was a shame about this boy being killed, who was as a result of a blow to the head in a boxing match. And somebody taunted me by saying, "Well, look, why do you just sit there and talk? Why don't you do something about it?" And since I'm an activist by nature, that's something no one must say to me, because I can't resist the temptation to rise to the challenge. So I said, "Well, I will." I took my napkin, turned my placemat, turned it over, and I wrote a motion addressed to the secretary of the faculty abolishing boxing. At the University of Wisconsin, the faculty has complete control over athletic policy. Even the regents couldn't overrule us.
I think I know.
That's a condition of membership in the Big Ten, that the faculty control boxing athletic policy. So I had everybody around the table sign that motion to abolish boxing, and then I spotted a few other graybeards around the room, and I got about 20 signatures. I sent it to Alden White, who was then secretary of the faculty, and it went on the agenda of the next meeting. I remember we met in the music hall. That is to say, we needed a large room. We had a huge turnout for a faculty meeting. That was a well-attended one. There must have been 500-600 people there. Mm. And since I had filed the motion, I had to get up and say something. So I made a brief statement as to why I thought it was an inappropriate college sport, and it was voted down by an overwhelming margin. And it may interest you to know, for the record, that I still have my file on that case, that our abolition of boxing made the world press. There were stories about the action of our faculty in Europe, in Asia, Australia. I got letters from all over the world.
My goodness, how did that come about?
And the farther away the letter came from, the more favorable it was to me. There's a worldwide movement against boxing. There's a worldwide movement which would like to abolish professional boxing. And our act in abolishing it at Wisconsin made the world press. I got a lot of nasty letters near at hand from local people, especially from former boxers who boxed on our team. And I also had some nasty phone calls for about a week. I had a bad week after that happened. But if a letter came from Paris or from Hong Kong, or then I knew it would be favorable, or somebody that thought we did the right thing. And may I say in conclusion that our abolishing boxing resulted in the collapse of boxing as a college sport in the United States. That was the end of it. We kept it alive because of the sheer prestige of the institution. And when we abolished boxing as a sport, a competitive intercollegiate sport, we pulled the rug out from under that so-called sport, and there is no more college boxing as a sport. It's an intramural activity. We still have a boxing coach here, the same one we had before, but they're not engaged in intercollegiate contests.
I can't say I'm sorry.
Oh, I've never regretted it. I think it was the right thing to do. I just think it's a brutal sport that doesn't belong, and it brutalizes the audience as well. It just doesn't belong, in my opinion, in a quality university. I was warned by some of my knowledgeable friends that some of the jocks, as we call them, would never forgive me. And this has been a monkey on my back over the years. I don't think the jocks have really forgotten or forgiven. But it wasn't a personal act. The faculty as a whole was opposed to boxing and adopted my resolution by an overwhelming majority.
Well, there had been an effort prior to this that
yes,
didn't go through.
Professor Walter Morton had campaigned for years in the economics department. He thought boxing was an inappropriate and dangerous sport and had raised the issue many times. But he never did get anything more than a motion to look into it or to investigate it or to study it. But I was advised that that's what I should do, merely move to have another study made of boxing, but my objections to boxing wouldn't have changed depending on what a study would turn up, because I thought it was aesthetically and morally improper as a college sport.
It is too bad that it took the death of a student before.
Well,
that's
often the case, isn't it? Something bad has to happen to energize people to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I have another.
I'm mortified at the thought that my reputation will depend on the fact that I made the motion to kill boxing. I didn't think it was all that important.
Well,
It had many followers, and it was a very popular sport, and we did pretty well in it. And since we don't do well in sports generally, there was some added animus directed towards me.
Well, I don't really believe that your reputation is going to stand on that issue. It just happens to be one detail that I was interested in.
Yes.
And there's one last thing in my mind. I came across a statement that this really is about general society, I guess. And I quote something you said in about 1950. Which is, you made a prediction that state welfareism will become a permanent part of society, unquote, and generally more government control in the next 50 years. Well, it's 30 years later now. How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, that was such an obvious prediction that I can make no claim to any particular insight in having made it. I don't remember saying that, but I could have said it because that has certainly happened, and welfareism of some kind is here to stay.
How do you see Reagan's activities in this area, in this connection?
I think the country will survive Reagan. He's only got a four-year term, and there's only so much harm that he can do, and we can pick up again when he's out of office.
So you think that this state welfareism is going to go on?
I think government and government activity is here to stay. You know. It's not a fly-by-night matter, but a matter of permanent concern to all of us.
Well, I've pretty much run out of questions, unless there's
that's
something
fine.
Else you
I've
have.
I've run out of
mind.
Gas. As I think back over my years here at Wisconsin, I think one of the most interesting experiences I had repeatedly was the opportunity to speak on other campuses. I've done a lot of lecturing in many universities. I've never added them up, but I suppose I've lectured in several hundred universities in the course of my lifetime. And this has been a very valuable experience. It's above all, it's heightened my pleasure in being here, because I've always had a better basis for comparison. We have professors here who've never been anyplace else, and they have no idea how well things are managed here, because they don't know how they're managed in other schools. And in order to appreciate an institution, you have to have an opportunity to compare it with other institutions in the same field. And I think that my satisfaction in being a professor at the University of Wisconsin was heightened by the fact that I never ran out of opportunities to compare how we conduct our affairs here and how other schools conduct them in other places. This is a spin-off partly of, though not entirely, but partly of my activity in the American Association of University Professors. But in any event, when I make judgments about the quality of academic life at Wisconsin, it's in the light of what I've seen in other institutions around the country, large and small, public and private.
Well, it's nice to hear that about our institution, isn't it? Yeah. There is one last question that did occur to me that I didn't, when we were talking about the TAs and their strikes and so forth, I was wondering what you would have to say about their legal position now when they're dealing with the university.
Well, they have no, there's no statute that requires us to permit the TAs to organize a union, and there's no statute law that requires the university to bargain collectively with the TAs as a union. The decision to go through collective bargaining with the TA Association was a decision made by Ed Young when he was chancellor, and I dare say for very good reasons that persuaded him. But as far as I know anything about labor law in this state, there is no statute law or case law that that holds that TAs have a legally protected right to engage in collective bargaining, and the university administration and the Senate in its recent action by setting up a new system indicated that they didn't want to engage in collective bargaining. As far as the law is concerned, I don't see any problem there. I think it's mainly a political problem, not a legal problem. Now, the legislature came very close to passing a law which would have permitted a collective bargaining on the campus, but it was not enacted. It was killed. The matter comes up every 2 years when the legislature meets for its biennial session, and it's voted down. They keep on voting it down.
Well, this isn't just for the TAs, it's with faculty.
For the faculty, yeah. But that, certainly a collective bargaining statute would have included TAs, however you write it.
Well, I was curious about that.
Mm-hmm.
I realize that I haven't asked you what your current activities are or your plans for the future.
Well, I must say that this is my third year of retirement, and I haven't yet come to terms with retirement. I don't know what to make of it, and I'm really a little curious to see the direction in which I will move. I would say that I'm doing about everything I always did, except I don't teach students or give grades, and not involved in handling graduate students, who take up a lot of time. I'm still invited by editors of learned journals to review books, and this I enjoy doing, and I'm doing quite a bit of book reviewing. And I've written a few articles since I retired. There's an encyclopedia of constitutional law which is going to come out in honor of the 200th anniversary of the Constitution's writing in 1887. 87.
And I wrote those. I've written some articles for an introduction to law recently. And I keep my hand in, but I spend much of my time just sitting here in my office. I come down every day. I do enjoy having lunch with my various colleagues from around the campus at the club at noon, the faculty club. I think that's why I come down. But just what I'm going to do the rest of my life, I don't know. I'll do whatever comes along in the way of opportunities. Next Friday, for example, I'm going down to Milwaukee to sit on a panel of the Midwest Association of Political Science discussing the future of research in constitutional law, the sort of thing I used to do when I was active. So I suppose I'm doing about everything I always did, except that I'm not involved in instruction of students or grading them or examining them. And above all, and for this I'm most thankful, I no longer have to attend department meetings, which I found very vexing. But where this all leads me, I don't know. I am reading books, famous books that I should have read years ago and that I always put off reading. For example, I have right in front of me, I never read Edmund Burke's Thoughts on the French Revolution, one of the great classics of the English language, just never got around to reading it. Now I'm reading it. So I hope that I can make up for some of the past in that way. I'm also reading new books that come out, especially in the field of constitutional law, such as this book on Felix Frankfurter that was just published. But that's how my life drags on.
Do you find you miss teaching and miss having graduate students?
No, I was awfully tired of teaching. I had 47 years of teaching, and I really got tired of it. Teaching is very, very hard work. Teaching university students is far more exhausting than most people realize who've never done it. There's nothing that drains your moral energies more than walking into a room full of people and try to speak to them seriously when half of them aren't paying any attention at all. This is very hard. And you have to keep reminding yourself that there's a minority there that's going to get something, and that's what you have to settle for. But the amount of energy one uses up in simply 1 hour of lecturing to university students is absolutely incredible. And people who have never done it have no idea. But don't let anybody ever tell you that teaching college students is a soft job. It's not if you care about your job, if you care about whether you're getting through to them at all. It's a nice question.
How about graduate students? That's a little different
situation. I kind of miss them. I enjoyed them. And I got to know them. And I knew, and I had a hand in their development. I could see that I mattered to them. But to have a class in American government, a beginning course with 150 students, of whom 140 are completely unknown to you, you just never know them. You don't know whether you're having any impact at all. But on your graduate students, you know. And some of my best friends to this day are former graduate students of mine who took their degrees and went out and had careers of their own. Just last week, I had lunch with a former graduate student of mine, one of my earliest students, who just retired himself from the University of Montana. And we have had a very nice relationship over the years. These are the students that you get to know best. Okay.